All right, so hi everybody. Welcome to the Kauffman Institute for Theoretical Physics. My name is Greg Dobler. I'm a postdoc here, as Dan said. I've been here for almost a year now. Really interesting, really exciting and fun place. And so he asked me to talk to you about research that I do here. I work on a couple different topics, but probably the one that people find most fascinating is something called dark matter. Has anybody here heard of dark matter? Whoa, okay, so everybody here has heard of dark matter. When I was in high school, I most certainly had not heard of dark matter. But that was a while ago, and so it was a pretty, it was a somewhat immature subject at the time. But we've learned a lot recently. But rather than tell you some of the specifics about what we think dark matter might be, I'd like to go through some evidence that we know it's actually a thing to think about at all. And that's partly selfish because we actually have no idea what dark matter is. And so we are trying lots of things right now and seeing what fits with data and stuff, but we don't really know what it is. So it's much easier to talk about how we know it's there in the first place. So that's probably what I'll tell you mostly about today. Okay. So evidence for the existence of this stuff. So dark matter, let's start off with another question. Does everybody know what electromagnetism is? All right, so electromagnetism is the, it's how light is made. It has to do with little particles interacting through charge, right? So like electrons, everybody knows what an electron is, and protons. When they fly by each other, they interact with each other through the electromagnetic force, and they're pushed apart or pulled together depending if they have the same charge or opposite charge. And so you're all probably familiar with protons, neutrons, and electrons, right? So these are the things that make up atoms. Protons and neutrons form the nucleus of an atom, and around the nucleus of an atom orbit these electrons. And then you're made up of atoms, this table is made up of atoms, Earth is made up of atoms, stars are made up of atoms, everything is made up of atoms. Well, stars aren't made up of atoms, stars are mostly, let's ignore stars for a minute. But basically, that's most of the stuff that you can see, right? Now, what is amazing is that everything that you see, everything that you can see makes up only 15% of the total matter in the universe, right? So if you look out there and you see stars and galaxies and you say, okay, that's what there is in the universe, that's actually not true. There's an additional 85% of stuff that you can't see. And what's really bizarre about it is that not only can you not see it, it's not just that it's made of the normal stuff, it's just not very bright so you can't see it. It's actually not made of the same stuff. It's not made of protons, neutrons, electrons, or anything that we know about. And so the question is, what is it? So how do we know that that's the case? So it all started with these two folks. This is Fritz Zwicky, who was a professor at Caltech, and Vera Rubin, who was at Princeton. So they found a couple of very interesting things. And so the whole thing really started in 1933. Quite some time ago, when Fritz Zwicky was looking at something called the Coma Cluster. All right, so what is the Coma Cluster? So we live on, the universe in astronomical terms in 2 seconds. We live on Earth that orbits the Sun. The Sun is in motion around the center of our galaxy, the Milky Way. The Milky Way is just one of hundreds of billions of galaxies that are in the universe. And for reference, the Milky Way contains 100 billion stars, like our sun. So just in a similar way to how stars form galaxies and orbit around galaxies, galaxies sort of cluster together. Right? There's a group of galaxies over here that are all sort of interacting through the gravitational force, right? They're all pulling on each other. And then there's another cluster of galaxies over here and over here, etc. The Coma Cluster is one such example. So all of these fuzzy things that you see, these are galaxies in the Coma Cluster. Just like our Milky Way, not exactly like our Milky Way, but something like that. They're galaxies in the Coma Cluster, and they're all pulling on each other. And now we know when we see some light from a galaxy, we can make some sort of estimate of how much that galaxy weighs, right? Because we know how much our sun weighs. We know how much our sun weighs because we know how fast the Earth is going around the sun, so we have some idea through Newton's laws of motion how much the object that's pulling on the Earth weighs. And we know how bright the sun is, so we can make some estimate. You know, if there's 100 billion suns in this galaxy and we know about the mass for each one of those things, we about know the total mass of the galaxy. And we count up the number of galaxies in the Coma Cluster, and so we know the total mass, and we know how much each of these galaxies is pulling on each other, right? Well, what FritzWiki found out was that that's not actually true. These galaxies were moving too fast to just be pulling on each other. So there must be, in this cluster of galaxies, some big halo of stuff. So these galaxies are sitting in a big bubble structure, a big blob of something that's pulling on them and making their velocities faster. So he didn't know what that was. It could be, at this stage, it could be any number of things. It could be normal protons, neutrons, and electrons that just aren't glowing very brightly but surround this whole thing. And in fact, every cluster of galaxies does have a big blob of normal stuff that makes X-rays, actually. That you can't see in this picture because we're not looking at X-rays, but there is stuff there, and so, okay, maybe that's the stuff. Turns out that's not true, but we'll get to that in a minute. And then 40 years later, 1975, Vera Rubin was looking at nearby galaxies, and what she was measuring was, you know, just like the planets orbit around the sun, and we can say, okay, how fast are the planets moving as, you know, as you go out from one planet to the next, away from the sun, how fast is each one moving? You can use that to say how much does the sun weigh, right? And you know where that mass is. You can do the same sorts of things with a galaxy. You can measure the velocities of the stars around the center of the galaxy and say how much does that galaxy weigh. Now it turns out that if the matter, the mass in this galaxy, was coming just from the stars, then the velocities, how fast the stars are rotating around the center of the galaxy, would kind of go up as you go out and then fall off. As you go out, the stars would be moving more slowly around the center of the galaxy, right? She found that that's not actually the case. The velocities start to flatten out. And so the implication here is that this galaxy is sitting, again, in some big blob of material, some big halo of material, that extends out to much bigger distances than the size of this galaxy, and that has a lot of mass in it. Okay? So that was in 1975. And now in 2006, there was this object was discovered. Now this really was sort of the defining moment in the whole dark matter. And the whole dark matter story. There were some other big defining moments, but in my mind, this was the one that really cemented this concept of dark matter. Because you can say to yourself, okay, in clusters, galaxies are moving too fast. In galaxies, stars on the outsides of outer parts of galaxies are rotating around too fast. So maybe it's just that we don't understand gravity at large distances, right? Maybe the mass is all where we see it is. But just gravity is not working the same. Maybe gravity gets stronger or weaker at large distances, and we don't really understand gravity. We only really understand gravity sorts of at the size of our solar system, or on the size of the Earth scale or something like that. But maybe we don't understand it on large scales. So, but then this object was discovered, and that basically puts the nail in the coffin of that idea. So, what is this? This object is called the Bullet Cluster. And what it is it's actually two clusters of galaxies. So some of the dots you see in here belong to two clusters of galaxies, and then there's a lot of stuff behind it, right? So if I draw all the way on the end here, everybody can see. We're standing out here, and we're looking, and there are these two clusters that are here, and then there's a bunch of other galaxies and stuff further away from us, okay? So what's special about this system is that it's two clusters that rammed right into each other. So these are really gigantic objects. These are trillions of times bigger than the Milky Way. Now, these are hundreds of times bigger than the Milky Way and trillions of times bigger than the sort of solar system size scales. Okay? So these are really big, gigantic guys. So now, what you're seeing here are X-rays. So these are big clouds of hot gas that existed in each of these clusters, and then the clusters slammed into each other like two trains. And just like two trains, stuff that's made of ordinary matter, like protons, neutrons, electrons, stuff that you and I are made of and that everything that we can see is made of, those things stick together and they heat each other up, okay? So it's exactly analogous to slamming two trains together. They sort of stick together, they kind of go through each other, there's a big mess, everything gets hot and explodes, and that's basically what's happening here. This gas is getting heated up as one cluster goes slamming through another. Now, there's something in astronomy called gravitational lensing. Has anybody heard of gravitational lensing? All right, fewer hands, that's good. So this is a pretty neat and useful tool in astronomy. It's something that I work on and have worked on a fair bit in the past. So these background guys here, which is actually most of what you're seeing in this picture, these dots and stuff, as light is emitted from these guys, it comes traveling towards us. It goes doot, 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 right? And so what happens when it gets to this cluster? Exactly. So this light ray feels the gravity from this, well, two clusters, and gets bent towards us, right? So gravitational lensing, it's called lensing because it's kind of similar to what happens when you put a lens in front of your eye. It can distort images. And in fact, when we look out at this picture and we look at the background galaxies, we can see that some of them are distorted. Like, for example, you can see here there's some distortions. Okay, maybe you can't see, but there's some distortions here that are sort of following a pattern. All right? So using gravitational lensing is only sensitive to gravity, right? So it's only sensitive to mass. It has nothing to do with electromagnetism. It's just where is the mass in the system. So if the mass in the system follows the light in the system, right, if what you see is what you get, then you should be able to use gravitational lensing to tell you that all of the mass is in these two blobs right here. And that's what Doug Clough and collaborators did in 2006. And so what happens is that this purple map, this purple blobs, it turns out is where all the mass is in the system. So the implication here is actually very, very profound, right? So you have two objects, two clusters, that are a bunch of galaxies sitting in some big halo of hot sort of gas made of electrons and protons and neutrons. And they're also sitting in some other blob of stuff, namely dark matter, such that when the two galaxies collide, the gas sticks together and heats up and does this, but the dark matter went right through each other. All right? So it's not just that the dark matter missed itself. You know, the dark matter missed each other and went this way. But they literally went right through each other. So this is really strange. And there's not really a very good analog that you would know about that I could tell you about. So there's nothing that I could really compare it to. But it's called collisionless, right? So two objects that are some blob of dark matter, if they collide, will go right through each other. They interact through gravity, but they don't interact through electromagnetism, so they don't stick together. So that's the evidence that we have for dark matter existing. We have clusters of galaxies where the individual galaxies are moving too fast, so we know that there's more matter than we're seeing. We have rotation curves, they're called rotation curves of galaxies, that the outer stars are moving too fast compared to the inner stars, so we know there's more matter there than we can see. And we see two clusters like this one that collide, and the total mass in them just goes right through itself. So this tells us that there is dark matter, and this tells us that it's not made of the ordinary stuff that you and I are made out of. And so I will stop there now. The big question is, you know, that's the evidence, but what is it? I won't get into that right now. I could talk more about that if you want me to. But I'll leave it there, and I'll take questions from you.
Yeah, using gravitational lensing, how do you know that how do you know what the path of the dark matter is? Like you said that the dark matter goes through itself, and that would imply that you know where it came from, like how its path, and how do you determine that?
So you don't have a good measure for the velocity of the dark matter, But so it's sort of circumstantial. It's kind of like seeing, you know, it's kind of like if you had a car crash, and you know you saw a big mess in the center, and then you know luggage and whatnot thrown off on either side. You could say, okay, well the luggage was there beforehand, and then the cars crashed in between the luggage, right? But it's more likely that when the cars crashed together, the luggage was thrown off, right? And then the luggage just kept on going, whereas the cars kind of stuck together. So sort of similar to that, we know that clusters of galaxies live in big dark matter halos. And when you had two of them collide, there's other evidence that it's collisionless. I'm sort of cherry picking in the sense that I'm sort of showing one example. But there's other evidence that it's collisionless. And this is sort of the strongest evidence that it's collisionless. But we suspected that the dark matter is collisionless and that it would go right through itself. And so we know that clusters live in halos. And so the most likely scenario here is that two galaxy clusters collided and the dark matter went through itself.
So the random position of the galaxy cluster, the galaxies relative to the dark matter.
So now that's getting into a little bit finer of a point. So you're absolutely right. The galaxies in the galaxy cluster, oddly enough, are where the dark matter is and not where the gas is. And the reason is because there's very few, relatively compared to their size, there's few galaxies in the galaxy cluster. So they don't, there's the likelihood that two of them would crash into each other is very small. You basically have a lot of little dots, right? And they sort of, they two galaxy clusters collide, the likelihood that there'll be two galaxies inside that cluster that have a head-on collision is very small. So they go through each other. So does the dark matter. But the gas in the galaxy, which actually is most of the mass of the galaxy cluster, sticks together. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
How did you take that purple color on the picture you showed us?
Right. So this was the gas. This is the stuff we know about electrons, protons, neutrons. And then this is a map that is inferred from gravitational lensing. This stuff is invisible. It's dark, right? It's been colored purple. It's not really purple. Ever since this picture was published by NASA, dark matter is now universally purple. But it's not actually purple. It's just to guide your eye to show you where is the dark matter. And you know this because, you know, we're standing here and we're looking out at this thing, and we see all these background galaxies here, and we say, okay, these galaxies have been distorted. Their images have been distorted through gravitational lensing. So if this is what the image looks like, what does the lens look like? The lens looks like that. Does that make sense?
How do we know dark matter isn't something like neutrons?
How do we know dark matter is not something like neutrons? That is a very difficult question to answer easily, but basically, we have a good idea for how many neutrons there are in the universe. And we have an idea for how neutrons interact with other things, in particular protons and stuff like that, right? Neutrons and protons get glued together to form nuclei and stuff. Right, exactly. And so we know that dark matter is not made of those things through various sort of indirect methods. Yes?
Where the red part where the two actually collide is, what is that? Just denser dark matter?
Or? No, so the red part, where these guys right here, that is, that's gas that is in the two galaxy clusters that when the galaxy clusters collide, sticks together. Okay, so the individual galaxies in the galaxy cluster are not very dense. There's not many of them per galaxy cluster, so they kind of go right by each other and they miss each other. But the galaxy cluster itself has this sort of hazy halo of gas, of mostly ionized hydrogen, so protons and electrons and stuff flying around, right? Now, but that guy is more dense in the sense that they're not like individual discrete galaxies, but the gas is sort of a big volume of gas, right? And when two volumes of gas collide, especially if they are ionized, they will interact with each other and heat each other up and stick together rather than going right through each other. So this is actual stuff. This is the same stuff that you and I are made out of. This is stuff that we are not made out of.
And that's why you can see it in the one picture before.
And right, and this is why you can see it in the picture. This is a real picture of light, right? This the stuff you see in the background here, this is pictures of light that your eye can see, basically. But this stuff is pictures of light at an energy that's much higher than it's at X-rays, right? So these are X-rays are being emitted by this gas. Same X-rays that you use when you break your bones and whatnot. Yes. Question.
Where do you currently
go into? Right. So now that really gets into. So I'm mostly concerned with. I'm concerned with this kind of stuff, sort of characterizing where it is and stuff like that. But I'm really interested in this question: what is it? Right, and now that's where it starts to get really technical, right? So I can throw up a slide really quickly that may not mean very much. But so, oddly enough, everything that we can see when we look out a telescope with telescopes and stuff like that. Is basically made up of this. This is basically the entire universe of what you're made of and what everything is made of, right in, you know, a few boxes. And this is the electron that you are probably very familiar with. These things are called quarks. Quarks are things that make up protons. So proton and neutrons, you know, quarks stick together and make up stuff. They also stick together and make up other things. But they stick together and make up stuff. And then that stuff sticks together, protons and neutrons, makes atoms. With electrons orbiting around, but there's other particles. That's a photon. But there's other particles, neutrinos, if you're familiar with neutrinos. But this is basically it. This is called the standard model of particle physics. Everything fits very well together. And so now the whole point about dark matter is it's that it's not in this sort of standard model, right? It's none of these guys, and it doesn't fit in this sort of standard model very well. So people postulate, okay, maybe it's a particle. Like a proton or something, or more likely like, or maybe like a proton, but it's just not any of these guys. And so they have some funny acronyms for it, like WIMPs, which stands for Weakly Interacting Massive Particle, right? People talked about MACHOs too, which are a totally different concept, but you know, the dark matter community, not having a lot to go on, comes up with very clever acronyms. So the idea is, the thinking is that a WIMP. This weakly here, you know, is kind of tongue-in-cheek, but it actually stands for, if you're familiar with it, the weak force, which is one of the four fundamental forces of nature: gravity, electromagnetism, weak force, strong force, right? And the thinking is that maybe this dark matter particle, which I call chi, this is a Greek letter chi, this is the sort of the universal symbol for dark matter now in the literature, that maybe these two dark matter particles, just like, you know that there's antimatter and regular matter? And it's pretty cool because when you bring them together, they explode, and so antimatter is very fun and it exists, blah, blah, blah. The thinking is that maybe the dark matter is its own antiparticle. And there's a reason to think that that might be the case. But anyway, so maybe the dark matter is its own antiparticle so that when you bring two dark matter particles together, they explode. Or more correctly, they talk. Is the jargon that is used to this guy, to the standard model, in some way, which we don't know about. But maybe when two dark matter particles come towards each other, something happens, and then you get out two electrons, or an electron and an anti-electron, which is called a positron, right? And so in the centers of galaxies, like the Milky Way, or in clusters of galaxies, or anywhere where there's a lot of dark matter, this process, two dark matter particles hitting each other and making electrons, could happen more often than it does just in free space where there's no dark matter, right? And so what I do specifically is I look in astronomical data for what happens when you make electrons in sort of regions of space where there's a lot of dark matter. And there's a couple astronomical consequences of that. So that's what I do. But I should probably stop because there's more speakers.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Okay, so now I'm happy to introduce the director, the director of the Institute, and director of the last 12 or 13 years, David Gross, who will welcome you and tell you something about this Institute.
So it's nice to see all of you again, not you, but the same group. So let me tell you a bit about the GIGB and then ask you a question. So, but first I actually wanted to ask you some questions. So I gather you're high school students from around the world. Is that right? Although I see a lot of Americans here. So how many are from outside the country? Okay, so mostly American students. And those of you from outside, where are you from?
Romania.
Greece. Turkey. Oh, I was just in Turkey. Romania, Greece, and Turkey. Okay.
Spain.
Are you going to win today? Who's from Spain? He's from Spain. And you're all inclined or interested in science? And what kind of science? How many of you are interested in physics? Well, that's a good number. And chemistry? Biology? Very few biologists. That's unusual. Interesting. So you're visiting the Institute for Theoretical Physics. So I imagine you're doing a bit of visiting of various laboratories and such. And hopefully, are you getting any hands-on experience this summer? With real experiments and stuff like that? But theory is different, you know. We don't have any laboratories or white coats or instruments. All we have are blackboards and computers and pencils and paper. And so what we do in this building is, over the year, bring together people from all over the world to do theoretical physics. So I remember when, you know, I think when I was your age, I definitely wanted to be a theoretical physicist and explore the most fundamental properties of matter and the universe, but I really didn't have any idea what it meant to be a theoretical physicist. What do? You go into your office and you think, which is more or less correct, except we try to enhance the thinking by bringing together people with different ideas and bouncing them off each other. And theorists like to do that. There's a misperception, which I'm sure you don't share, that scientists are nerdy types and, you know, loners and socially inadept and work alone in their offices on crazy ideas, and totally wrong, as you hopefully know. And in particular, theoretical physicists love to interact with each other and talk and explore ideas together, and that's one of the reasons for the KITP. So we try to identify, with the help of colleagues around the world, important questions that are ripe for study. You know, some new discovery is made or someone has a new idea, and plan a program which brings together top people around the world to spend weeks, months together here, collaborating, listening to each other, criticizing each other, and advancing that particular area. So we have typically two such programs running at a given time, maybe 20 to 30 people in each program sitting here, together with our permanent members, scientists who sit here, you know, we're UCSB physics professors, but sit here. There are only five of them. We also have postdocs. You heard one of our astro postdocs talk about dark matter, and you'll hear Josh talk about string theory. And so we have about 15 postdocs in the building, five permanent members, and about, at a given time, 50 to 70 visitors from all over the world. About 40% come from outside the U.S. There are about 1,000 visitors a year who come through these, through the KITP. So the moment, this is a bit of a down period. Usually the building is humming, but we're just switching from one program to another. And what is physics? Well, we interpret physics very broadly. So physics ranges from astronomy and astrophysics that you've heard about, which is obviously physics. They're studying the properties of a new form of matter, which connects to elementary particle physics. But sort of the one end is cosmology and astrophysics, and then particle physics and condensed matter physics, which is an enormous subject, the physics of ordinary matter or quite unordinary matter that we create in the laboratory, material sciences, but all the way to biology. We have about, at the moment, something like 15 to 20% of our programs are on what I call the physics of living matter. So these are physicists who have theoretical physicists who have gotten interested in all the marvelous data that biologists are beginning to collect and to try to help in the understanding of that data. So we have the human genome, presumably has a lot of information about how cells work and evolution occurred, but nobody exactly knows how to understand all that data. And physicists are a very arrogant bunch. They feel that they can do anything, and they have very good techniques and methods honed over the years, and they apply them to new areas all over the place. And biology is a very popular area nowadays because it's so exciting. There's so much data, and there's so much that is now known, and so many different approaches, and so there's a it's reached the stage of maturity that a theoretical approach, model building, and the like can really be fruitful. So a lot of physicists have started working on such problems, and we try to, one of the things we do here is try to bring scientists from different fields where they often have problems talking to each other because they don't understand the language of the other field, or they live in different departments in universities and don't normally collaborate. But here they can come together and learn each other's language and contribute different skills to the same problem that occurs in nature. So that's what we do at the KITP. And people who come here really enjoy it. It's one of the other things I often tell young people who are entering science is one of the nicest things about science is the fact that you share common pursuits, trying to solve a particular problem with lots of people all over the world. And wherever you go, any country you go to, you'll find people doing the same thing, talking the same language. That's certainly true at an institute like this is one of the meeting points where people come from many different countries to work together. So I just came from a Lindau. I don't know whether you have heard of Lindau, but when you later on in your career, you'll have a chance to go there maybe. It's a place where a lot of young people are brought together with Nobel laureates. There were 60 Nobel laureates at this meeting from all different fields and 700 young scientists. It's not for high school students, it's for really for graduate students and postdocs. And it was amazing to see all these different young and old scientists from all over the world discussing all the aspects of modern science. It was just like there, I had a long session with the students where they had just asked questions, and I'll let you ask questions. And then we'll hear from Josh. They have until 12.
A little before 12.
And Josh has prepared. You could talk forever. Now you could talk everything you wanted to hear about string theory. But anyway, so I'll take questions before Josh speaks. Yeah.
And how do you apply theoretical physics to biology?
How do you apply? Well, it's not that. So physics, you know, has a long history, rather a successful history, about 400 years old, of making sense out of rather complicated phenomena. And over those centuries, it's developed lots of tools. And physicists are trained to think in certain ways. So when physicists get interested in biology, they're interested in the biological questions. And they, especially this modern generation of physicists, really immerse themselves in the field. There's some outstanding issues. And then they try to apply the tools that work so well in the physical sciences. Now, biology, living matter is very different than dead matter. And you can't just say, okay, as some people have tried in the past, we're a physicist, we can do anything, tell me what your problem is and I'll solve it. Usually hasn't worked very well. However, physicists who really immerse themselves in this new, in biology and learn what the questions are and what is understood, what the data is, have found that they're able to think in ways, because of their training as physicists, that biologists don't necessarily think. They're very good at it. Physicists are trained to take a complicated problem, strip it of the inessential, try to get down to the bare bones, what's important, and then construct simple approximate models that, and then test them. And then proceed in that way. And whether or not they will be very successful compared to biologists who have a very different approach. Biology has been, until recently, much more of an observational science, remains to be seen. But so it's not like saying, okay, well, biological questions fit into a framework that already exists. It's more, we have a tradition, a way of thinking, techniques. I mean, we have techniques that have been developed for very complex systems that we could try to apply. But it's really more of a way of thinking. Physics is a very good way of developing a way of thinking that has proven in many fields to be advantageous. For example, a field that is much in disgrace nowadays, finance. I mean, Wall Street has hired lots and lots of string theorists and other theoretical physicists, not because they know anything about economics, but neither, it seems, does anyone else. But rather, they just have those skills that can be applied just about to any complex problem. It's a very good education. we physicists believe.
When you choose a subject to work on in theoretical physics, do you have an idea of a problem, of how to solve that problem that you choose before you start the problem, or do you enter the problem hoping that some approaches that you try will lead results?
Well, it's a good idea to have some idea of what at least is a good direction to pursue. Otherwise, you're really at loss. I think most of the time you have some idea or some bag of tricks that you try. But sometimes it's absolutely clear. I mean, most of the time, I would say that most people work on problems that are little steps from what is known. So based on somebody else's work, or a new discovery, or just what they have been doing, they add a little bit. So they're little steps. The harder thing is when you try to make a big step into the darkness, and there's no continuous path from what you already know to the solution to the new problem. And I like to compare research to climbing a mountain in the dark with fog all around you. If you're faced with that task, get to the peak in the dark. One thing you know is locally, right, which way is up. You can sort of feel that, right? That's up. So now you have no idea whether the path you're taking, which is up, is the right one, or it'll eventually go down and the peak is over there and you first have to go down to go up and so on. But if you have no better information, you just start out going up. And you have to be ready to fail and try different things. So if you go up and you fail, you don't get to the top, you get to a barrier or something, well, then you go back and try again some other direction. You have to be willing to try lots of things and wait for an inspired guest and be able to recognize that you're going in the right direction. Often, people engage in the famous street lamp strategy. You know what that is? It's the man who walking down the street and he sees somebody searching desperately on the ground right under a street lamp, and he says, what are you looking for? Can I help? He said, I lost my keys. He said, you lost them here? He said, no, I didn't lose them here, but this is the only place with light. So a lot of the times we just go to the nearest street lamp and look under there. Maybe you'll find something.
Is the path to theoretical physics generally the same, like undergrad, graduate, postgrad, and then you work in research at university, or you mentioned sometimes you get hired by companies, that kind of thing?
Pretty boring, huh? Yeah, normally that's the way. I mean, there are some people who in my case, it was just, it's more or less. But everyone's path is different because the science is different and what you do is different. And right. Physics students who graduate in physics, undergraduate degrees in physics, do all sorts of things later. Physics graduate students also do all sorts of things. Not all of them end up in academia. Some of them are hired by companies. Some of them are hired by Wall Street and who knows what. Those skills are quite transferable. But for research scientists, you got it. That's the path. Yeah?
I'm just curious, because this is such a modern classroom. What is the
effect? This isn't a classroom. This is, that's where we normally, why don't we have a whiteboard? it depends. Some people like whiteboards. I hate them because they have, Well, you see, blackboards you can erase with your hand. You do that with whiteboards, you get all that icky stuff on you. Which, and those pens dry up, whereas chalk remains, this will remain for centuries. And it has a visceral feel to it that is very comforting, I must say. So, this auditorium is rather new. There was no way I was going to put here black whiteboards. We don't have any whiteboards in the building. In fact, outside in this little atrium where you see people sitting around at a table drinking coffee and talking physics, there are granite blackboards on all these on the wall behind there so people can get up and talk. So blackboards are nicer there. This is where we hold these, you know, most of our activities, which, you know, somebody's telling about their ideas and lots of discussion going on. So it's like a classroom. But we don't actually have any real teaching here at the Institute. There are some graduate students, about 20 graduate students who are come with the visitors or apply to our graduate fellow program. Do you like whiteboards? You haven't thought about it. More common? Yeah. I think they're subsidized by the pen companies then. Turkish, let's see, you already asked a question. Yeah.
You mentioned that you always knew you wanted to study theoretical physics, but what sparked that interest?
Actually, in my case, it was just reading popular science books. George Gamow and Eddington. This was a long time ago, but I liked math and solving problems, and the idea that you could use your mind to figure out how the universe works seemed to be so attractive that I decided real early on. And I was just reading books. Yeah, that's a nice thing. As said, there's a path. You know? And if you're good enough, you can go down the path. Well, it's nice. It's much easier to be a scientist than to be an artist or a composer or a playwright, where there are a zillion obstacles in your way and it's hard to make a living. As a scientist, you know, society encourages, supports, helps, and really wants people to go into science. Turkey again.
I'm really curious about, like, how theoretical physicists get their results. Because, like, for example, like experimental physicists and like chemists and biologists, like, they have a hypothesis. They design the experiment and like they test their hypothesis, right? So like, right, they have something to work on, and they can see, like, from their results, they can see that if whether like their opinions are right or wrong. Mm-hmm. How do theoretical physicists?
Well, in many fields, in a similar way, they think about a problem, they come up with hypotheses, and then they tell the experimentalists to go check them out. But in some, but nowadays it takes a long time to test ideas, and in some fields like string theory, where I work, we're far from being in a position to truly test the theory, if we have a theory at all, and so it's trickier. There are fields that are data rich. Certain areas of astronomy and astrophysics are data rich. Very complex, have lots of suggestions and ways of testing ideas, but the phenomena are very complex and difficult to model or really understand, construct predictive theories. Biology is a field which is incredibly data rich. Physics, there are areas of material science and condensed matter physics that are data rich. Doesn't necessarily make life easier. Then there are fields which are data poor, and those are often the ones that are at the frontier, the absolute frontiers of something. In the case of particle physics, the absolute frontiers of energy or distance. And they're extracting new clues from nature is extremely expensive and takes a long time. And we often proceed on the basis of very little data. So it's very different in different fields. And again, it's really, science is enormously varied. And different people like different kinds of science. Some people really could not stand to work on string theory because it has so little contact with experiment, ongoing experiments, and so few clues. Some people could not stand to work on material science because although there's lots of data, it's messy and dirty and complicated and not getting to the heart of things. So everybody has different tastes, and it's all important, but different. Sorry?
Search an idea, which direction
to go? most of my life, I must say, well, a good part of my career, I was pretty certain. And I had a lot of, some very important early successes, which bolster that confidence. Whether that's good or bad, it's both. It's very important in general, I think, in life, and especially in science, to be confident, because you need some confidence to pursue things, pursue directions to their conclusion. But of course, it's dangerous to be overly confident and stubborn and not realize when something has failed or not working. But and not to be afraid of failure. So in general, I would say, I'm the kind of person who's usually pretty certain, and it hasn't, in my case, proven to be a mistake. And I think it is important. But it's important also to recognize when something isn't working, and not to just to stick to be overly stubborn, not recognize either other possibilities, other people's work, reality. But you need a certain amount of confidence or certainty to, try to climb up the mountain in the dark.
As a theoretical physicist and someone who's trying to understand the universe, do you personally, feel that there's a higher power or something, or that it's all rational and
I give a lot of talks around the world. Every once in a while, somebody asks me whether I believe in God or, can you see God in the equations? And I usually say that hasn't been necessary to address that in science. So it doesn't really come up. If you're asking about whether I believe in God, is that what you're asking?
I'm asking, because you study how the universe works, do you feel that it is purely rational or that...
Well, there are... so it's important, in general in science, to differentiate questions that are well posed scientifically and that are not. And as science advances, more and more questions that weren't really scientific questions become scientific questions as we learn more. Now, you're right that some of the questions we ask today were truly only asked by religion or by non-scientific thinkers not too long ago. And the origin of the universe is one of those. How did the universe begin is the kind of question that many religions were, you know, were answered, or religions answer that question more or less. It's one of the religious questions people have been asking for forever. And it's not really a scientific question. You know, when I was a student, I don't think you could have gotten a paper published in a scientific journal on the origin of the universe. We just didn't know enough to be able to ask that question scientifically. And that's changed. And it's really fascinating because nowadays the origin of the universe is a real scientific question, which means that we can imagine or try to get information that will allow us to address that question by observation. We're trying to think of ways to see gravitational waves way back to a few nanoseconds after the Big Bang by theory, theoretical modeling. And you can write a paper about the origin of the universe and write down your ideas about your solution to how did the universe begin, what is the initial state of the universe, and what is the Big Bang, and get it published in a respectable physics journal. So that's a change. That question is now scientific. Used to be religious. Therefore, when I think about the origin of the universe, I don't think about, you know, the religious aspects of it. I think about it, the scientific aspects of it. How could I think of ways I might observe what went on near the beginning of the universe, and how could I construct the model that would determine the initial condition, explain the Big Bang, et cetera, et cetera. And they're very interesting ideas. So it becomes a scientific question, and I don't need any supernatural stuff. Now, it's true, it used to be, and it still does impact on religious beliefs. But so did other questions that have long ago passed into real science, such as, what is life? Now, what is life used to be a religious question, and life was created by the Creator, etc., endowed with life. And it's only recently that it's become a scientific question, much less recently, but still only 100, 200 years, maybe since Darwin. But now we think, you know, enormous advances have been made to what is life? Can we create life out of inanimate atoms and so on? We're close to doing so. And it's, again, very threatening to religious or philosophical ideas which thought they had a monopoly. There, as you know very well, especially in this country, there's tension between turf fights over who owns that question and is it threatening. But again, the scientists who are approaching the origin of life and we're trying to create life in the laboratory, by and large, don't need to address the supernatural aspect of that question. They can approach that question, like the origin of the universe, by purely scientific means. So I'm actually much less interested in questions that can't be approached scientifically. And there still are questions that can't be approached scientifically. But more and more, many of the questions that used to be outside of science are being brought into scientific reason and exploration.
Now, there's a famous quote from Einstein who said something along the lines, the most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it's comprehensible. It is literally.
Well, yeah, I disagree with Albert there. We are creations of the universe. We've been selected to you know, natural selection works to enhance, select for abilities to make sense out of the universe around us, because that's of selective value. So it's not surprising that we understand the universe.
Maybe
we can't understand. Okay, so let's, I will end here, and we can now hear about the theory of everything.
Thanks, Dave. So we do have another nice talk about the mysteries of the universe from one of our postdoctoral fellows, and Dr. Pan, Titus Gree at Harvard, another Harvard spot today. And in fact came directly from his PhD work here to the Institute, where he's doing postdoctoral research. And as you heard, he is a string theorist, and we'll tell you something about that most interesting stuff.
Yeah,
well,
this is the chocolate.
A whiteboard.
Yeah, no whiteboard for me either. No, I like the dust, like when you go home at night, you can really see that you've been working. Thank you. Yeah, so David was saying that that physicists are supposed to be arrogant and think that we know everything. I'm actually kind of the opposite. I don't think I can do anything. So, if including teaching. So, if I'm not doing a good job, just feel free to interrupt me or raise your hand and ask questions, okay? So, right. So, I'm going to attempt to tell you about string theory before you have to leave. But let me first motivate it. So, there was this great question about, what motivates research in string theory when we don't have a connection to experiment to test it? And that's a fantastic question. Of course, most of science is intimately connected to experiment. And unfortunately, we're currently not. But that doesn't mean that we aren't motivated. We have thought experiments that we can do that test the boundaries of the theories that we have. And those can sort of shine a light in a direction forward. And that's exactly where string theory came from. So, string theory. All right, so there were sort of two frameworks that are pillars of 20th century physics. There's Einstein's description of gravity, which is called general relativity. Has everyone heard those words before anyway? Okay, so we've got general relativity. And that tells us about large objects. That tells us about how the Earth goes around the Sun, and things of that nature. And we have our other framework. So these are two frameworks. We have our other framework, which is quantum mechanics. Has everyone heard those words before? Quantum mechanics. Okay. All right, good. Okay. And fortunately, Greg put up a slide at the end, which allows me to use this word now. We have something that's called the standard model of particle physics, which has had the quarks and the electrons and explains protons and atoms and all of these things. Okay, that's the standard model of particle physics. And similarly, kind of related, within the framework of general relativity, we have another standard model, which is the standard model of cosmology, which attempts to explain how the universe started and expanded and gave rise to the matter that we see today and the structures that we see today. And we know that both of these are incomplete. Okay, there are plenty of examples, and Greg talked about dark matter, of how both of these models are incomplete. Okay, but these are models within a framework. The framework sort of tells us the basic principles of how we should try to put different things together to reconstruct the universe. So we know the models are incomplete. That doesn't necessarily mean the framework's incomplete. But where string theory sort of comes from, it is from thought experiments that actually
show that these two frameworks are incompatible with each other. And a lot of tinkering over the years has kind of demonstrated that it's a lot easier to kind of modify general relativity than it is to modify quantum mechanics. So that leads us to want to invent a third framework, which sort of unites both of these, which is quantum gravity. So we need to have a theory of quantum gravity in order to have a theoretically complete framework, or at least a more complete framework. And here the word quantum really means some, you know, indivisible bit. So in particular for gravity, the quantum of gravity, the smallest gravitational wave excitation you can have, we call a graviton. Okay. Are there any questions so far? Okay, so if we are going to have quantum gravity, we have to have particles called gravitons. And the way that quantum mechanics works is if you have the moon going around the Earth, the way the gravitational force is transmitted between the two is by exchanging gravitons. They keep sending them back and forth, and this talking to each other is what keeps the moon in orbit around the Earth. And that's how quantum mechanics works. Okay, so great. That sounds easy enough. All we have to do is take gravity and declare that there are some smallest bits of gravitational waves we can have, and we're done. But that's not the case. Yeah, question.
On the chart for the elements of the standard model, I saw the gluon. Sorry.
Yep.
Is that the conveyor of the gravitational force?
That's the conveyor of the strong nuclear force that holds protons and neutrons together in the nucleus.
So what conveys the gravitational force?
Good. So that's exactly the graviton.
Graviton.
Yep. And so that wasn't in that chart. It's not part of the standard model. Other questions? Yeah. No, definitely not. In fact, the existence of gravitational waves, which are sort of large collections of gravitons, has not been directly tested. But that is something that we expect to be tested in the coming years, within the next like 5 or 10 years. But everybody I know believes in the existence of gravitational waves, at least. And probably most people I know also believe in the existence of gravitons. But a hard-nosed experimentalist might not. So, other questions? No, I don't mean it as an insult to them. Yeah. Okay, other questions? All right. Okay, so, and in fact, if we replace these, by the way, with say a proton and an electron, I could draw the same picture for how an atom works, except that they'd be exchanging photons. They'd be exchanging electromagnetic radiation to keep the electron going around the nucleus. Okay? That was the weird. Okay. All right. So now let me draw this picture in a slightly different way. So let's suppose. So time is going, let me draw bigger. Time is going up, okay? Time is increasing this way. We start off observing the Earth at this time and the moon here. And unfortunately, I'm confined to two dimensions. So they kind of move along in time and we observe them at some later time here, okay? We see the moon hasn't crashed into the Earth and it hasn't flown away. So there's some balance. Okay, so what quantum mechanics tells us is, well, we know what happens at the beginning when we observe, we know what happens at the end. How do we calculate what the force between these two objects is?
And quantum mechanics tells us that we have to basically consider every possible way that they could have interacted in between. So, for example, they could have exchanged one graviton, or they could have exchanged two gravitons, or three, or so on, and so on. And the way that we compute in our theory what the force between them is we have to add up all of these different possible ways that they could have exchanged gravitons. Okay? Now, when we do that, we find a problem. And this is a problem, of course, with our theoretical framework and not with the world, because the world works. The moon does go around the Earth. But what happens is, when I say we have to sum up all possible ways things could have happened in between, that includes emitting a graviton at this time, emitting a second graviton at that time, or emitting the first one here and the second one there, and so on. And what we find in our theoretical framework is if they're emitted one right after the other, we get a very large contribution to the force between these two objects. And in fact, as we take them together, we get an infinite contribution. And that makes no sense, of course, because the moon would have crashed into the Earth long ago, or escaped, or who knows what. I mean, we wouldn't be here to begin with. So that's obviously wrong. So the most naive attempt to quantize gravity, which is the same thing that we did to quantize electromagnetism, fails. Now, it turns out in electromagnetism, there's sort of a nice way, there's a known way to deal with these infinities and get rid of them without making a drastic shift in our paradigm of how the world works. Okay, we can still talk about quantum particles and construct a theory that does make sense, that does allow us to calculate things. In gravity, it's not as easy. In gravity, just by trying and failing many, many times, it appears to require a paradigm shift, and that's where string theory comes in. So I should say there have been other attempts so far. String theory seems to be the most successful one. That doesn't make it right, but it's been such a hard problem that, at least to me, I think it's important to take seriously anything that seems to have been successful in resolving these issues. Okay? So, any questions? Okay. All right, so string theory does the following. So I said before that the way that the old paradigm worked was treating objects like the electron and the photon and so on as points, as zero-dimensional objects. Okay. The way that string theory works is by sort of promoting these. Instead of points, we treat them as little loops of string. These are one-dimensional objects. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but the amazing thing is that it actually seems to work. And in fact, this is how string theory started, but now there are a whole host of other dimensional objects that we use in string theory. There are two-dimensional objects that we call membranes. There are also points, and so on. But let me just focus on the strings. Okay. Yeah, I know, it's crazy. So the important thing about these is that the length of the string, the typical size, is something we call the string scale, and it has to be very small. It has to be, let's say, just to put a number on the board, let's say it has to be much smaller than 10 to the minus 15 meters, which is roughly the size of a proton. Okay, if it weren't much smaller than that, it would conflict with experiments that we've performed so far. So it must be that at the distance scales that we've looked at, strings are so much smaller that they behave like point particles. Okay. Now what happens though if we start looking at these diagrams that got us into trouble, at these pictures that got us into trouble where we took two gravitons together? What happens is as I said, we really only run into trouble when these really coalesce and come right on top of each other. What that's telling us is that our picture of gravitons as point particles is breaking down when we get to very small scales. Something else must happen when we try to take these two lines together that prevents us from getting infinite answers. And that's what this string picture does. If instead of the Earth and the Moon, I talk about two fundamental particles interacting, let's say two electrons, so that's not the best example. Now we treat also the electrons as little bits of string. And as they move through time, they would trace out cylinders. So we look at some initial time, we look at some later time. In between, they trace out cylinders. Now, if they interact in the interim, they interact by exchanging strings, then I have to draw this line across. Okay? And everywhere, this is really, you know, a two-dimensional object. So I've just taken this picture, and I've just kind of fattened the lines. Now, why does that help? It helps because the problem was exactly that these sort of interactions were happening at points. But here, the interactions don't really happen at points. You can't really say that this string was emitted from this other string at any one time. It kind of is smeared out. It's kind of spread out roughly over a whole region here. Okay? And it turns out that smearing out of the interaction is exactly what lets us compute finite answers. Okay, so according to string theory, when we start to get very large forces by taking these two gravitons together, what's really happening is we're discovering that we shouldn't be treating them as point particles anymore. We should be treating them as sort of extended objects, as strings. Okay, so that's kind of the crazy notion that string theory puts forth that actually seems to work quite well. Any questions so far? Yeah?
So instead of an infinite number of interactions that are infinitely narrow, you have finite with non-zero finite with things that basically there's only a finite number that you can stick in between the two cylinders.
Well, there's still an infinite number. Yeah, sorry, I should keep drawing these. Yeah, so it's really the finite width thing that's saving us. I can still draw, two exchanges, or three, or four, or so on. So there's still an infinite number of things that we have to sum up. But the infinities that we were having trouble with weren't coming from the fact that we had to sum an infinite number of possibilities. It just came from the fact that these two things were coalescing right on top of each other. Other questions? No? Yeah?
What's the problem with them coalescing right on top of each other?
Yeah, so that's a problem with the theory that I don't have a good intuitive explanation for, unfortunately. But yeah, it's just that if you try to use the theory to compute this, you get infinite answers. Yeah, you get 1/0, basically. Yeah.
Can strings occupy the same space?
Can what? Sorry.
Strings occupy the same space.
Yeah. So actually, I'm about to come to that sort of topic. So ask me again in a few minutes if it's still not clear. Other questions? Okay. So. Can strings occupy the same space? That's perfect lead in. And the answer is yes and no.
Well, that makes perfect sense.
So it depends what you mean exactly by the question. But string theory sort of requires extra dimensions, okay? Which is another thing that sounds completely ludicrous. Completely ludicrous. So we seem to live in three spatial dimensions. And we typically write 3 plus 1, but 1 means time. Okay? So we live in 3 plus 1 dimensions. String theory wants to live in 9 plus 1 dimensions, 9 spatial dimensions. Yeah, still only one. There's still only one time. But we really don't know how to make sense of theories that have more than one time dimension. Unfortunately, string theory has only one, so we're okay. But yeah, we have 6 extra dimensions that we have to somehow get rid of and wind up with our 3 plus 1 dimensional theory. And that seems like a big problem. But we'll actually see that it's actually beneficial to us in a few minutes. But for now, it looks like a big problem that we'd like to get rid of. And there are a few ways to sort of get rid of the extra dimensions in a way that we don't see them. So let me just talk about the first one. Let me talk about it in the context of a toy model, because that'll actually let me draw pictures on the board. So let's say that we live in 1 plus 1 dimensions. So we live, so our space is just a line. And let's say that string theory lives in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so string theory has some extra dimension. Now, somehow we have to be able to get an effective theory that only looks one dimensional out of a theory that's 2 plus 1 dimensional. So the way that we postulate, one way we can try to do that is by postulating that the extra dimension is so tiny that we haven't seen it yet. That's the same thing that we said, by the way, about strings. We said that the strings have to be so small that they act like point particles in all of the experiments we've done so far. Okay? So we're just doing basically the same thing that we did before, which is trying to hide away the extra structure that would screw things up. So let's say that the extra dimension is just a circle. It's a tiny, tiny circle, okay? That means that in reality, at every point in our one-dimensional space, there's actually an extra hidden circle that we can't see because it's too small, okay? There are a whole bunch of circles here, and if you string them all together, then it might look like a cylinder, okay? So we might see that our space is a line, but string theory sees our space as a cylinder. Now, again, that circle is really small, and what we can do, just to emphasize that, is we can zoom out. Well, that starts make that circle get smaller and smaller until it just kind of looks like a line if we get far enough away. Okay, so what that means is if we had 2 objects sitting along the same circle, and let's say one object sitting over here, what that means is to us, it looks like these 2 objects, A and A prime, are just sitting right on top of each other. But B is sitting over here in some distinct location. Yeah?
Is the length of a cylinder the direction of time?
No, sorry, I didn't draw time in this picture. I only drew space. There is time, but I only drew space. Yeah?
Does string theory say that electrons are strings or that electrons are made of strings?
So the original form of string theory, if we're ignoring all these other types of objects, would say that electrons are strings, and that all the fundamental objects are strings. And that sort of raises the funny question of, if there's only one type of string, how is it that all of these different particles that are supposed to be strings can behave differently? But I don't know if you had some other question first.
No, I just wanted to ask that.
Okay, great. Great. Does anyone else want to ask something? Yeah.
So why are you extending the spatial dimension? Is it not possible to have an extra dimension of time?
It just turns out that mathematical consistency of the theory, which is a very strong constraint, and it's one of the other constraints that we have, since we don't have experiments. So mathematical consistency tells us it has to be 10 dimensions, 9 plus 1 dimensions.
Oh, I'm asking why does the extension of dimensions must be spatial?
That also comes from the theory, actually, from the mathematical consistency.
Any other questions?
But I think it does anyway. It could have been an assumption, too, that we only want one. But, yeah. I haven't thought about that. So, all right. Let me just check that I'm not skipping something. Yeah, good. Okay. So I wanted to go with this next topic of if everything is supposed to be made out of a string, which is supposed to be the fundamental building block, how is it that we can have electrons and photons and gravitons and all these other particles that behave so differently from each other? And this is where it turns out that the extra dimensions that seem kind of like an embarrassment that we just tried to hide away by making small actually play a crucial role. So how can strings differentiate themselves from each other? All right, so maybe this word appeals to some biologists in the audience, too. We've got string differentiation. All right, so first of all, so the first way doesn't revolve around the extra dimensions. It's just the fact that these strings are loops of, well, they're strings that have tension. And just like a string on a violin, if you pluck it, it vibrates. And it has some modes of vibration that are characteristic to that piece of string. So if we just have we can have a string that's just sitting here. Alternatively, we can have a string that's vibrating a little bit, or it's vibrating a little bit more, or so on. Okay. And that vibration is energy that's been added to the string. Okay. Just like, I mean, it takes effort to pluck a violin, and, well, I guess you don't pluck a violin, but it would take effort to pluck a violin if you did. And that effort gets converted into vibrational energy of the string. Yeah?
Can strings expand and contract, or are their lengths constant?
They can expand and contract. And that'll be important in 1 second, actually. So, good question. So, but as I was saying here, these oscillations are adding energy to the strings. But remember, to us, these strings are so tiny that they just look like point particles. So to us, they just look like a bunch of point particles. And we can't see that they're vibrating strings. But that energy has to go somewhere. In our, you know, we must be able to somehow see that these behave as objects with different amounts of energy. And Einstein tells us that energy is related to mass. And so these vibrations create, for us, the illusion of point particles that have different masses from each other. Okay, so that's one way that strings can differentiate themselves from each other, just by vibrating. Okay, the second way relates to this question about whether strings can stretch. And the answer is yes. And if I draw our nice picture with the extra dimensions now, you could take a single string and sort of wrap it around as many times as you like. And since it has a tension, the more times you wrap it around, the more energy you're adding to it, because you're stretching it out, just like stretching a spring or a rubber band. Okay? So again, just like we saw for this vibration, by stretching it out, we've added energy to it, as compared to a string that's just kind of sitting here and not doing anything interesting. And so again, this stretched string has more energy than the unstretched string that's just sitting here. Sorry. Okay. And again, to us, we don't see the string, and we don't see the extra dimension. So all we see are a couple point particles sitting here that have different masses from each other. Okay. Yeah.
Are the changes in energy like quantized? Is there a minimum change in energy?
Yeah. So here they are quantized. And the energy scale set by that is related to the length of the string, because it just has to do with having a whole number of peaks of oscillation. Here, when we're stretching it around the extra dimension, the scale is set by the size of the extra dimension, because that's the length that it has to be to wrap around it. Yeah. Yeah, it's like my shoelace, once I tie it off. No, if I just tie the two ends together, the two ends of my shoelace together, then it would be a loop. You have to draw it. If you're going to draw it, you have to draw it in a two-dimensional, on a two-dimensional board or higher. But if you're living on it, you know, if you're like a little ant, how many legs does an ant have? Anybody know? Six? Actually, if I step on them, I can't count how many there are anymore. So there are six legs, and the little ant is living on the loop, and it has to walk around on the string. Then it only sees that it can go forward and backward. And so that's what we mean by saying that the loop is one-dimensional. Because if you live in it, then you can only go forward and backward.
It's locally one-dimensional.
Yeah, it's locally one-dimensional. That's locally two-dimensional. That's a whole other topic. Yeah.
How does string theory explain the charge?
Yeah. So that's a great question. That involves getting into more details of string theory, unfortunately, than I have time for. But it can relate to, we can also have strings that aren't closed loops, that are open line segments. And those relate to charged particles. But yeah, unfortunately, I don't have time to really explain that right now. But good question. Yeah.
So how did this all start? Like, did someone just think about maybe a string work? Like how?
It started from a completely different point of view, actually. It started in trying to understand the strong nuclear force, which is the force that binds together protons and neutrons inside of an atomic nucleus. You would think, if you didn't know about this force, you would think that these nuclei could never stay together because the positive charges of the protons would repel them. So you know there has to be some force that holds them together, and the strong nuclear force is the force that's related to that. And what people noticed is that the force kind of grows, the force between two objects kind of grows linearly as you pull them apart. And that sort of led them to think, maybe these are like the ends of strings, and as you pull them apart, you increase the force.
Oh, okay.
That turned out to not be right, but people then realized that it actually had this other application, which is quantizing gravity, which was pretty amazing. So, yeah.
So in principle, with say high enough energies, would it be possible to directly detect, say, a string? Just in theory. No.
Yeah. In principle, it's absolutely possible. In practice, it's not. I think I don't remember the energy scales, but I think the accelerator would have to be larger than like the orbit of Pluto or something. I mean, just impossible really. Okay, yeah.
So is strings basically the smallest unit as
something extreme as well? No, strings are the smallest unit in string theory, in the string theory description. Good question. Yeah?
Because most people believe like string theory is decades, if not centuries, from being finalized. And like, do you think that there's a way that it'll possibly be finalized in a lifetime? Well, not a lifetime, but, you know, and, do you think it'll be finalized, or do you think it'll be something that just remains a theory?
I think that actually it sort of appears from our current understanding of it that it will just be a part of a final theory. But I'm not sure I personally believe that we'll ever have a final complete theory that explains the universe. I certainly hope not either, because it would be kind of boring to get to the end and not have anything new to discover.
So I don't mean to sound like I don't love string theory, but how do you justify to people that what you're working on is essentially a really cool thought experiment?
I mean, you just have to remind them that, first of all, we're cheap compared to experimentalists, you know. We're much cheaper. We don't require, as David said earlier, we only need paper and chalkboards and pencils and computers. So you don't have to try that hard to convince them to fund you a little bit. And second of all, you know, we're still searching for truth, and we're still trying to make contact with experiment when it's possible. The beauty of universities is they don't have to see some return on their profits next year. They can invest in some kind of long-term thing that doesn't even have to have any potential measurable value to society. Sure. Yeah?
Coming back to your second model on constraints, stretch and theory, can they break?
So strings can break and join, which is kind of what's happening here. And they can stretch. I suppose in principle they can stretch infinitely, but it requires adding an infinite amount of energy to stretch them infinitely. Yeah.
Strings aren't
like
physically there, are they?
Well, string theory treats them as though they are physically there.
What are they?
Well, they're strings. Yeah. But that's it. Well, so they're supposed to describe. So that's actually the last thing I guess that I wanted to say. So let me say that. So before I said they're supposed to describe gravitational interactions. They're supposed to describe graviton. But what we learned is there are actually these different ways strings can distinguish themselves from each other. The third one, let me just say it quickly, is that it can be spinning around the extra dimension. And again, that gives it some energy, which is bigger than one that's just sitting there. And again, that appears as some massive particle to us. And so the point is that we have these ways, even though everything might be a string, we have these ways that strings can look different to us when we're colliding things in our particle accelerators. And so it turns out that these extra dimensions that were kind of shameful to begin with actually turn out to be very useful, because they allow strings more ways to differentiate themselves. And in fact, people have been able to devise six-dimensional spaces that give strings the ability to appear as all of the different particles that we see in nature, qualitatively. We can't predict masses or anything like that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
Are there like different types of strings, or is it all like everything the same thing?
Yeah. So there are different types of. So for one thing, there are already different types of objects that we didn't even talk about. And for a second thing, there are sort of different types of strings. But it was understood more recently that they're actually all sort of related to each other by changing some parameters in the theory. Which is a very vague statement, I know. But let me just leave it at that. Yeah?
Is there a finite amount of string in the universe, or is there like a changing amount?
So answers to that question are going to be the same as answers to the question of whether there's a finite amount of matter in the universe, which I think Greg talked about a little bit with discussing dark matter. So the universe that we see appears to be finite, and so there's only a finite amount of matter at any one time in it, speaking loosely.
Is it possible to change the type of string, like the dimension of the string, from like a one-dimensional string to a two-dimensional string? Is that possible for any individual string, or are they? Or
they don't. Static? They don't jump in dimension, but they can interact with each other in really bizarre ways. Yeah.
Does string theory have a set of fundamental equations?
No, not really. That's one of the things that drives us forward. Is trying to understand string theory itself. We sort of understand what string theory means if you sort of imagine that we have these. If you imagine that we have this sort of space that's parameterized by the different kinds of parameters that we can tune, like the shape and the size of the six extra dimensions, as well as some other things. Then there's this whole range of possible models that we can get out of the framework of string theory. But the problem is that we really only understand how to do computations around certain very special points. We only really know what we're doing around these points. But there are other reasons that we know that they're all kind of connected. So the problem is that we have equations that sort of let us understand the theory around these points, but they don't do any good for us inside. So inside, that's kind of a mystery, and that's what that's one of the driving forces behind string theory research. Yeah. Yeah, that's right, and that's part of this part of this graph. I didn't label it, but let's call that one M theory. So the really funny thing is different points in here can even be related by changing spatial dimensions. Yeah?
So as far as like bridging the gap between general relativity and quantum mechanics, was the object of string theory to create a tool to solve a much bigger problem, or was it just so we can like live in a more determined universe?
No, it's not. I'm not sure if you mean determined as in predict with absolute certainty what happens. It doesn't do that. It's quantum mechanical. So everything is probabilistic. The problem was that gravity wasn't probabilistic before quantizing it. So we had to make it probabilistic too. Yeah. Yeah.
Is string theory applicable to dark matter?
So string theory is really a framework, and you can build models where you have types of strings that look like particles, that look like they could be dark matter.
What dark matter particles are, we can't really say that they have certain strengths that are characterized.
Right. So they're not really necessarily any more inspired than any other model of dark matter. Yeah.
How are theoretical physicists currently working to further develop string theory? What are you guys doing to it?
So David's lamppost discussion is really largely the way string theory research moves forward, which is we try to solve problems that we believe we can solve, and we hope that we learn something that lets us tackle a new problem that we didn't think we could solve before. Yeah.
Strings can be stretched, and there can also be two-dimensional strings. Couldn't like a stretched two-dimensional string be visible?
It is possible, and people have talked about stretching strings so large that they become visible. It's unlikely because it requires adding a lot of energy to these things, and in the meantime, they could break up into smaller strings. But it is possible. And nothing like that has been observed. You could observe it. There was some talk for a while of cosmic strings, which are, you know, really, really, really long objects that you could detect by using gravitational lensing, which Greg was talking about before. And they have the very telltale signature of creating double images of any object that's behind them. So, you know, any galaxy directly behind them, the light would get bent both on the top and the bottom, and you would see a line of these double images. Those have not been found, but it's possible. Yeah?
So when you're stretching string, so you're adding energy to stretch it, right?
Yep.
Does it, according to string theory, does that mean you're physically adding string, whatever that is, or is it just a framework for adding energy?
So energy itself is sort of the more abstract notion. So the physical process that's going on is maybe two strings are joining and making one longer string, or...
What's the difference
between like making it vibrate at a different frequency and stretching it?
Are they both adding energy, or is it just a different way of adding energy? It's sort of a different way of adding energy.
Yeah.
What do you do with this theory every day? Like when you come here, what do you do?
Well, you have to walk it at least twice a day. What I do with it is I try to... So again, string theory is a framework, just like these were frameworks. So what I try to do is I try to look at some toy model that's sort of in one of these regions that I can actually understand how to do calculations, and I try to calculate properties of that model and see if I learn any effects that could be sort of generic.
It's great because it stirred up so much interest, but we are getting close to limiting the time, so maybe how about two more questions?
So are you choosing the questioners now?
No.
I have to choose? Who hasn't asked a question who wants to? Okay, it's only people who ask questions want to. Okay, so I don't know. The two of you, I guess.
If strings can break,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't that mean that they're not the indivisible fundamental unit of the universe?
No, because they break into other strings. So if these two strings... So if I just draw a cartoon, I have a string like this, then it can... let's draw three pictures. It can sort of start to eventually split off into two strings. So if it breaks, it breaks into more strings.
Yeah, but wouldn't that mean that there's the string is made of something smaller so that the two separate strings can occur?
Well, two separate strings can occur, but the only way that this can break into two separate strings is if it had enough energy to be able to break into two separate strings. So if we had stretched it out, like if we had wrapped it, well, that's a bad example. But
I think what he's saying is that since you can stretch a string infinitely long, or you can break a string into something of equal size,
mm-hmm.
that the things that make up strings are uncountably infinite, like they're continuous. So therefore, there must be something that exists at every point of that string.
Well, first, they wouldn't be uncountably infinite. They'd only be countably infinite because you always have to divide into integer numbers. But second of all, there's sort of a base amount of energy that a string can have. So if you have a string that has the lowest amount of energy it can have, that one can't split into two strings. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah, so
and then the last one.
You said that strings exist in one dimension, and however, it seems sort of paradoxical because one defines a point, but the strings can be they're malleable, which means like you can stretch them.
But you don't get to fatten them out. They're still.
You
can stretch them lengthwise, but you can't fatten them. Like they don't get any width.
When does it turn from a point to a line?
Well, they're not a point. They are a line. It just to us, because we're so much bigger than they are, they look approximately like a point. But yeah, they're not a point.
But there's a lot of great talk, obviously, stirred a lot of the questions, but I'm afraid there are limitations both on your time and on some of the things around here. And much as I regret it, I think we're going to have to cut it off. And thank Josh again for a very